You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius.
Black as you, black as us, black as free, black as me, black as you, black as us, black as free.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, our guest is Umar Ben Hassan. Umar is a member of The Last Poets, and I am thrilled to bring you this interview with him. If you're a longtime fan of the show, you know we've actually had Umar's Last Poets groupmate, Abiodun Oyewole, on an earlier episode of the show, and that was just an epic conversation that traced, you know, 40 or 50 years of cultural history, black history. And this is another conversation along those lines. I'm thrilled to bring it to you. We just cover so much stuff. Umar, then known as Hank Hewling, growing up in Akron, Ohio, as a shoeshine boy, and the adventures he had there. The riots in 1968 in Akron, where he and others fought the police for 6 days, and he had to leave town basically on pain of death. You'll hear his story around that. Shortly after arriving in New York, he joined The Last Poets and was part of their most famous and seminal historic work. And he's done a ton of things since then, both on his own and with The Last Poets. I'm so proud to bring you this conversation. It really just traces so much important stuff. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL51. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further Outside the Lines. And now, here's our conversation with Umar Ben Hassan. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean, here with Umar Ben Hassan of The Last Poets. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here, Sean. You know, good to meet you personally and close. So I'm glad to be here in these great surroundings of all this genius.
Well, thank you so much. I think the thing that put us in contact originally is something a lot of people might not know about, which is a short story turned into a comic book called Up South in Akron, 1959, that you wrote and that in collaboration with Nate McDonough and Bill Adler, and that we have on the site. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, for the ages now, Bill Adler has been trying to give me the right things, and I don't know, Bill, please, I don't have time. I'll be so busy. So he just kept at me and at me and at me for the last 10 years, you know, maybe even longer, because we met about 2 years ago, because he was a publicist for that first album when I came back to the group in 1990 that Island Records put out, Bebop or Be Dead. And so we became somewhat instant friends then, you know, and we've always kept in touch. So he's always known about the aspects of my life. So, but then one day I was like you said in the beginning of the when he shows on the comic book that, you know, we was at this Japanese restaurant. I started telling him about some of my adventures as a shoeshine boy in Akron from the age of 18 to 15. He said, "Well, come on, we gotta write some of that." So for somehow, Sean, I just said, "Okay, I'm gonna relent. I'm gonna break down and write through some stories." So it was that story about me beginning shoeshining. Then I read some other stories about the competitive little Shoeshine Boy I ran up against, who that's some really crazy stuff. And then there's one about the gypsy boy. I didn't even know there were gypsies in Ohio at the time that I ran to on the street, and the whole, he introduced me to the whole gypsy culture. It was really amazing me. And there were some things, and you know, I didn't understand, and there were some things I was told were lies, so that, and then other things about my survival as a young man in Akron, Ohio. So, boom, you know, we rolled it, and then he went around. We hooked up with Nate, the cartoonist, to one of the probably most prominent writers of comics now, Ed Piscator. And Ed survived. He liked it, but he said, I don't have much time. You know, Bill, but I can hook up with you, a young guy, I don't know by the name of Ed, Nate McDonald. So we, the three of us began, you know, communicating almost every day on the internet. We're at this point, at this point. So that's the thing, when we got through, you know, Bill tried to get around, but there were some people just weren't ready for it, didn't want to do it. But then, boom, he said, listen, there's somebody at Rap Genius who wants to put up. Who was you? Who I'm very grateful for the opportunity. So I said, yeah, boom, put it up.
Rap Genius.
And so we got up. You know, a lot of people looked at it like that. And I've shown a lot of people. I went to a lot of my friends over in Europe, perhaps certain things like film companies and spoken word organizations. They said, well, Mom, you know, there's some things we can do. One girl asked, we can turn the whole thing into a drama on stage, you know. And so I said, okay, I'm thinking, but then I'm saying, well, right now I'm Rap Genius has it up, but I'm going to Europe in August, in London for about 7 days. I'm going to talk to some people that say, I'm listening to everybody, man, you know. Actually, I'm not in a hurry because I like the comic form that it's in right now. I really do. I like that. And I was just amazed to go back and see some of those things that I've done in my young life, put on paper. Really amazed me, man. And it also made me aware how far I've come as a human being, you know. So, you know, go back to my childhood age and some of the things I had to go through in order to survive. Yeah, it was something special for me.
That's amazing. And the thing about Akron is just a few years from the times portrayed there, once around 68 hits, things got really crazy out there.
Right, yeah. Well, the whole riot thing, which yeah. I was part of. And then once and once about Akron itself, because Akron itself, it was a nice place, but it was just, I mean, you had his race in the Midwest sometimes, would be just as segregated as down south. And then, but there were, you know, people, white people who lived with each other, and what comes, you live with plants there. So they were both races working on those plants. I worked in one of those plants for a while, Firestone Tire and Rubber. But the thing about Akron was the Akron Police Department. The fact that for all those years, it had totally, you know, brutalized and humiliated or constantly rounded our uncles, our brothers, our cousins, and our fathers, and we just got tired of it at that specific time. You know, end time today, we got to stop this. So we rose up, had a little thing for 6 days on Hoosh Avenue, but you know,
six days.
Yeah, about six, you know, about, what was it, from the, what was the 18th to the 23rd? About 5 days, for about 5 days. And so now, you know, this is Ohio now. This is where the National Guard killed people in Kent State in 1960.
Just a few years later.
But then too, see, they weren't playing North Dakota. They had several machine gun nests on most of them. I'm telling you, Sean, they had several machine gun nests next to the fireplace on the fire station on Worcester Avenue was where mostly it was contained, where it mostly happened. And but somehow, and then me, I'm going up and down my street when they come down my street with the half tanks. I'm up in the face. Come on, man, we can fuck up my street. They say, you know, my mother, a whole lot of
people. You're in front of tanks.
Oh, yeah, there was half tracks coming up and down the street and, you know, Jeeps with the machine guns on them. And so, you know, I'm running up with beer bottles in my hand. I left my mother and the women on the block. All thought I was going to die because I'm up in their face. And then, I mean, some women, I don't know, one of the Sundays when they were still on the trip, some of the women walked past my house and they said, well, we're going to pray for you, boy. We're going to church. We're going to pray because everybody thought I was going to die. I was crazy, man. I was 19, man. I was ready to throw down, man. You know, this whole thing that here, y'all can just take up our community and sell a machine gun. That's like we're just some type of object or alien nation or something. It really upset me, man. But we had, like I said, we had them going for about 5 days. We made a nuisance to them. But, you know, they had the manpower and they had everything. So it was over. in about 5 days, but I had to get out of town because the Akron Police Department, after it was over, sent a letter of recruitment to my house. And everybody knew that I was one of the main instigators of the so-called fomented moment. You know, and everybody knew back in 1968, you know, in 68 at that time, in Akron, Ohio, they couldn't set you up. So my mother said, you know what time it is? I said, yeah, I got to get out of here. And I knew it, but I lost my job. Well, I got fired from my job because they saw a picture of me in Akron Beacon Journal.
I say Bill told me about there was a picture of you on the paper getting arrested.
They had the National Guard, but they can't find it. I'm quite sure. I think Akron destroyed that picture. I mean, they probably didn't know that I'm on it now. They probably gave it, because Akron now is trying to pretend that they didn't want to pretend that it ever happened. But anyway, my mother saw the picture, son, and she said, damn, of all the niggas they had to take a picture of, they had to catch you on the Akron, the front page, coming with the gun to your back. And so, man, everybody knew that, like I said, you know, and probably other people would say, yeah, the Hank Ewing, because there was a lot of snitching going on. I always was a lot of snitching going on. But yeah, it was Hank Ewing. He was one of the main, he was. So when they sent that letter, my mother even know. She said, you know what this means? I said, yeah, I got to get out of here.
So this was a draft letter they sent you?
To recruit me to be on the Akron Police Department.
Oh, to be on the police department.
Yeah, because this is, everybody knew that's what we was up about, the Akron Police Department, to get some more, because at that time, there were probably about five. Those two on the comic strip. I think that was Archie Bullock and Joe Thomas, who they embarrassed that day. Then they had Jim Craig. Okay, I said Archie Bullock, Joe Thomas, Jim Craig, Goodrich, and I forgot the other one.
So what was the threat implied in sending you the recruitment letter?
Well, you know, the thing was, like, they would probably get me down there and set me up in some way and kill me.
Oh, wow, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, well, my mother did, and I did.
Obviously.
You know, and I did, so I'm six times grinding. Now, I lost my job. I give up all my clothes. My brother told me, my young brother always tell me, yeah, during that time you gave up your beaver skins and your gators and your lizards and your herringbone suits, and I was just giving up all my, because I had changed now. I got on my khaki, outfit and the boots, so I had no money, nothing. So I said, I'm going to get out of here. So what happened was, my sister had a record player, those old 7833 that you stack a pile of records on?
Yeah.
And it plays one at a time, 45s. So I pawned that. She didn't know it at the time. I pawned it, and I got $25. And at that time, a ticket from Akron, Ohio to New York was just $15, man. This was 4 years ago, it was just $15. So I paid the $15 for the ticket just one way. And the other 10 I spent along the way at the post stops, the ground stops, you can buy food. So when I landed, Sean, at Akron, Ohio, in New York City, in February 1969, I had a book of poetry in a bag with a pair of jeans and 22 sitting in my pocket. That's all I had. That's all I had when I landed. See, now I had met Abby O'Doon the summer before in Antioch College when we were doing the reading. At that time, it was just Abby O'Doon, Felipe, and Guy and Kane. David Nelson had left in the original Gunga player, Elijah. So me and O'Doon had gotten into a thing because I was head of security at the desk to come in for the festival. I would check. Everybody at the desk. So Doon came to doing this. He always had, when he was young, he had this booming voice. I'm Abby O'Doon of the Last Poets. I don't care, man. My name is Brother Omar. I'm a security man. What's up? I ain't gonna get checked in, man. I'm from New York. I'm from New York. I had to get checked in. I said, yeah, brother, you need to check in. Or you check out. No, man. I don't have to get checked in. So I just pulled up my khaki jacket, and I had a 45-38 strapped to my side. So I said, listen, Holmes, you either check in or check out, okay, baby boy? And so he reluctantly looked at the guns and Doon checked in. But then when he got on stage, when he got his baby wig, he got off of me. He said, yeah, who's that crazy motherfucker y'all got out there to shoot the gate? He'll kill all of us before he kill white people. So I said, okay, homeboy got a little stuff, but he got a little spice. So, but after, Shonda, when I saw what they did with the drums and the poetry, it fucked me up, because I began to write down poetry. But I even more advanced poetry than I did for the Shoeshine World, because I began to play dozens in high school with words,
Yeah.
And so I began to play, I was good at words, and then...
What was your favorite thing in the dozens. Do you remember your best one?
I had a lot of them. I can't. What did I say? There was something where your mama shouldn't get close, too close to fire because she wears some panties. This plastic was a name that catch fire and was plastic. And I forgot. That was my favorite thing. I just say, you know, she sitting too close to the fire because she would burn up your whole ass. I forgot the name of it. And then a couple of more, you know. But I can't remember the name of the plastic. It was a plastic that caught fire easy, too. So I said, your mama wears so-and-so panties, so she shouldn't get too close to fire. But, and then my high school senior day, you know, everybody has high school, I wrote this big poem about all my teachers and a lot of my classmates, and I didn't write about this principal I hated, Mr. Schifano, Charles B. Schifano. I hated him. I didn't like him because he knew I was a big instigator against him in high school and everything. I didn't like him, but then he came up to me after the senior year and said, I knew you could do that. I knew you had the intelligence and creativity. Yeah, man, leave me alone. See, I graduated, they graduated me with 2 C's of DNF. They just wanted to get me out of South High School because I used to keep it roused up, you know? So, but at least I did get out and graduate. I didn't quit either because one time, for my junior year, I mean, if you know that if you've been in high school, your junior year is when you were just, what she is in high school because you don't know which way you want to go, you know? So I was all messed up with my junior year. I don't know what I want to do. You know, I was playing football star, track star, you know, I was good, you know? People called in colleges, but I almost quit to join the Marines.
Wait a second.
One of
the last poets.
But I wanted to be a Marine, man. When I was a junior, I wanted to be a Marine, man, because I used to see all the movies about the Marines and how heroic they were. And I read a book about Chester Puller. Matter of fact, when I was in junior high school, I had a teacher, Thomas, ex-Marine. He used to be a weightlifter, Mr. Thomas. He always talked about this guy, Chester Puller, who was a hero for the Marines. I read about Chester Puller. He was a big hero. So I wanted to be a Marine, you know, and I liked those uniforms of white, blue uniforms. I thought they were cool. But, however, this was a time during the Vietnam War. So they were showing these body bags coming back from Vietnam. And some said, fuck the Marines. Fuck the Marines, man. You ain't gonna be no Marine, because them little 5'3" white city boys were sending big, strong, buck, you know, black and white boys on my body bag. So I said, no, because, I mean, these people are fighting for their land. You know, they might not make it. But I thought I would be able to make it. I wanted to be in Fort Recon, too. The first ones to go in and check it out and make some hits with that. I wanted to be in Fort Recon. But that didn't happen. So, like I say, the ride went down. I got an Akron, and here I am in New York City trying to be a last poet.
What was it like when you first arrived?
Oh, man, let me tell you something, Sean. Because, you know, when I got off of that stop at 125th on the 7th Avenue 9, and there was a people drugstore at that time on the northeast corner. And so when I came off of that, this is the first time I'm going up to Harlem. When I came off that subway and came up to all the crowd of people, different type of people, and gay ladies and kufis and silk suits and all kind of different dresses, knocking up against the wall. Because I've never seen so many black people in so many different aspects of different parts of our culture, man. I just, and for about 5 minutes, I stood up against the wall and I jumped right in the mix. Jack. And before you know it, you know, this crazy little nigga from Africa, man, he all, man, there was people wanting me, giving me, offering me crews to be part of the little, you know, because this nigga got courage, you know, he up against everybody here, you know. Because I, you know, I'm a wrestler, but I come to play this game, really get down. So, but I told him, no, I don't want to be doing nothing like, because I'm a last poet. So, you want to be what? You want to be the last poet? You want to be the last poet, man. And so when I did finally become a last poet, and when we were last poet, the first time we played Apollo, a lot of big drug pens came to see us, you know, Nicky Barnes, Frank Lucas in the picture. They all came to see the last poets, man, backstage, because we were like the princes of Harlem at that time. We really were. Young black men just happened to, some words happened to come to our heads. A lot of times we didn't even know that the influence that we have in the world, because people will come up and tell us, yeah, I stopped doing drugs because of Jones coming down, or, you know, y'all saved my life in Vietnam. I mean, I thought people just blowing smoke up my booty hole, man. Yeah, well, I'm 19, 20 years, white motherfucker, whatever. But then it seems like we all had to go through some changes to find out how powerful what we were, because we were so far ahead of our time at that time. Our stuff was more relevant now than it was back then. Huh?
How
do
you mean?
Yeah, it's more relevant now. So we do, you know, wind up going down to North Carolina, want to be a revolutionary, go to jail. I wind up going to thing with drugs, the law went off, went practically crazy. And when I really began to realize the influence that we had brought to the world, what our wolves had done, and not the fact that Mick Jagger or Boy, what's his name?
David Boy
liked us, is that we were in the Netherlands, and this is about maybe, 4 years ago? And, you know, we'd been arrived out of Amsterdam so much that that was like second home, Rotterdam, Amsterdam. But this time we did a tour of a little outside the boondocks, like Eindhoven, Leeward, Utrecht, and so on. So we began off the bus, you know, to go out and check out the venue. And these people our age, Sean, would come past, would come and start walking to us with that blue and yellow album and plastic, talking about, we were just waiting for you guys to get here. Fucked us up. And y'all were listening to this, but say, yeah, we were listening to y'all back there and over here and here. And as a matter of fact, talking about David Bowie, he was in Detroit one day at the Silver Dome, but what was it, up in Michigan, where the it's not the Silver Dome, anyway, it's a big auditorium up there, they have where the football play, and they have a concert. Mm-hmm. And so he was just doing a concert, and somebody told him that, you know, Omar Ben Hanson is just up in Flint, Michigan. I don't know who told him. He said, what, Omar Ben Hanson is in Flint, Michigan? He said, get him down here. So he sent a car up to get me and my partner. We went down to watch the show. He put us up front, you know, acknowledged me that I was there. So but the funny thing happened was when, after the show, we in the green room. I mean, my partner, we're about the only two black people in the green room. All the rest of these are car executives, big time car executives from Ford. This is a rich, I forget the part of, didn't come to me, of Detroit, of Michigan. But anyway, there's about 55 people in the studio. So all of a sudden, when David opens the door, he's coming in, all these white people rush toward him. But he rushes past them to come over to help me, man. Tell me, oh, wow, man, come on. Do you know who y'all influenced? You know, David and me, Mick, you know, Mick Jagger. Yeah. All of us were listening because one of our poems was in his movie, Mick's movie back in the 70s.
Oh, the performance.
Yeah, performance. Yeah. So he told us all who was listening to us, man. I'm like, whoa, okay, all right, you know. I began to understand a little bit more how important that we were to the culture of the world, not just America, but to the world.
Yeah, and you've spent a lot of time overseas. You said you're going back there in just a couple weeks.
At the end of August, yeah, for a week in London.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you something for people who weren't around in the late 60s. It's almost impossible to imagine the climate. You get a little bit of an idea of it listening to your first record. But the idea of revolution, like, that seemed imminent, right? That seemed like this was actually something that might happen.
I mean, Sean, we had the powers that be on their heels for a minute. And we all knew that. And it wasn't just the Nation of Islam. It wasn't the Black Panthers or the Last Boys or the Public Avenue, but the white kids too, the SDF, the Weather, especially the Weather Underground, the two boys. They blew up, they weren't playing. The Weather Underground, matter of fact, some of them sometimes, they would be on the run, some of them would sneak up, if we was in town, they would sneak into our concerts. Come on, we love you guys, we love what y'all doing. I said, well, we love what y'all doing too, man, keep it up. You know, so, you know, and it was deep, man. As a matter of fact, the brother who died in Chicago, police, sometimes his sons, they have a meeting every December to go to a place. He was killed about 3 years ago. We went to one of some of the old cats from the white people and the Indian movement over there. Some of us cried to see that some of us were still living, man. So it's a good thing. But yeah, man, we had them on the hills for a minute.
Then Cointelpo
came in. And see, CORN Turbo, they just thought CORN Turbo came in during the 60s for the Black Panthers, but COINTELPRO had been operational since 1944 because J. Edgar Hoover had already had it in place to use it for other things. So they, but they just heightened, they cleaned it up, they enhanced it to make it a star. You know, next thing you know, because I was a Muslim, I tell you, next thing you know, brothers that you've been making Muslim with, and since Salam Alaikum Muslim police, or brother that you've been in a shootout with, he was, but you don't know who to trust no more. A lot of people became disappointed and disillusioned. You know, a lot of people went back in love, like myself, or Finney. You know, and Finney was one of the most brilliant legal minds at the time, because you know she won her case. And we used to go down there during that time, during Panther Turnover, a lot of us would go down and support and send the courtroom. As a matter of fact, the judge told her to her face, you know, if you want such an embittered and angry Black woman, you could be one hell of a lawyer or legal. Mine, you know.
Rap genius.
But so there were some people, man. We were a generation that was deep. But see, the only thing that we regret, that we made some moves and we upset some things and we made some points, but we didn't leave the generation coming behind us with anything to have early on. Like, we let them know factories. We let them know mom and pop stores that they could deal with and have. So they began to find other ways of supporting themselves, of sustaining their destiny, like drugs, hip-hop. So everybody always talk about Jay-Z and this and that hip-hop, but I don't blame them, young kids. I mean, there's some bad seeds in hip-hop and some stupid seeds, but then also some of these young men have made grand contributions to their families, to their communities, and to this country. You know, so that's when David Nelson made that statement. I guess you heard about that statement that he made. Well, David Nelson, one of the older guys, made a statement that it came out the other day, and this guy from, what's his name, Whitlock or whatever, from sports, he writes for sports, Fox Sports, and he said David had told everybody in his interview that it was a hip-hop that killed Trayvon Nelson. And you know, me and Dune had to write something to back the other way up. No, man, you don't beat up on these kids. Because, and you in Ghana too, and then we got to take the heat for this. Because no, about 2 days after, we looking on all these, like all
heads. Is this the last all, poet
yeah,
said?
Yeah, last poet said, and Dave's time for them to turn in their legendary and revolutionary status cards. I said, oh. So we, you know, I myself and Dune had to jump over and wrote some, you know, retractions. And I said, David is part of the last poet, but doesn't speak for all of us, though.
I was going to ask you about the Martin case and the Zimmerman verdict and your thoughts about that.
Well, it's you know, I don't know, it's for centuries and centuries, Black men have been killed in this country, and nobody has. It goes all the way back to Emmett Till and Cheney and Swaney and a whole lot of other Black men and women who were racing lips. And so for once, we were hoping that maybe there was a chance for that to be erased. And the verdict was, it blew a lot of us, it just blew our minds, because we were hoping that we could see that it was a clear case of murder, you know, whether it was racist murder, whatever, it was a clear case. Even just take away the race out of it, that it was a clear case of murder, man. He murdered that young boy because the young boy, I think, probably was getting the best out of him in a thing, and he killed the boy, which he shouldn't have, wouldn't happen if he had followed direction. Don't follow, leave him alone. But, you know, man, and it's just like, you know, it's boom. But then there was a case up in Milwaukee where this old guy named Spooner shot this 33 about last year, but he finally got convicted this year, where he, and they were showing a video on YouTube where he killed this 13-year-old boy, shot him in the chest, shot him to death. We saw the beginning of the boy is taking the family garbage can and putting it back to the back of the house. This white man, old white man, he's about 7 or 6, comes out and says, what are you doing? You're stealing from me. I know you're stealing from me. This is what he told people. The guy was stealing from him. So they got a little argument. And he had his 38. First he pointed at the young boy. Then his mother came out on the porch. And she said something. He pointed the gun out of her. And like he said, you got some say business? Like, she didn't say nothing. But then he turned the gun back and shot the young boy in the chest, killed him. But they just killed him. And I'm saying, whoa, man, I was upset for that. That upset me more than watching or hearing about Trayvon Wilson, how he just, you know, with him, man. Yeah, just shot these people. Just shot that boy to death. So it gets the Black man, you know. But then, too, what gets to us is that there's so many of our young kids killing each other. I mean, we, you know, when people say, well, white people kill each other, too, but we have to make an effort to stop learning these young black men to stop killing themselves, man, or setting themselves up to be killed because people use the justification. Y'all kill each other, so boom, how you gonna get upset because we free you? And that's the justification that's being used now. Because every time you see somebody arguing on Fox News or TV, the white people say, well, what about your own communities? What about your own communities? Man, so it's this racial thing. You know, if anything is going to keep, it's going to bring America down, it's going to be the racial thing. It ain't going to be the terrorists. It's not going to be the Russians. It's going to be the race. The fact that we haven't got over race in the last, haven't got over it yet, 40 years of being here. Everybody comes here, you know, they know how to deal with people of color, the English, the Spanish, the French, but we still have not learned how to be real with one another. And everybody always talk about discussion on race. Yeah, but it's going to be a real discussion. Both sides are going to have to admit some of that bullshit that they're responsible for because it's like this. You can't be blaming one side or one side blaming. Both sides will have to admit some things. And I don't think, you know, both sides are ready to do that yet.
Rap G's.
You know? Yeah, and you were a very, with The Last Poets, you were a very important part of what came to be known as the Black Arts Movement.
Yeah,
I don't know
yeah.
if you thought of it as that at the time.
Well, yeah, but we thought we were part of it, and the head of it was Amir Baraka, whom we call our father. We call him our father because...
I know Dune was very close to him.
Yeah. We all are very close to him because at that time, you know, there was a lot of so-called more intelligent and more notarized black poets at the time who were kind of scared of us. They didn't know how to take us. Because you know, using this language, niggas, fuck, this, you know, raw and hard. So, you know, they're into the very intellectual discourses of the lines and the, you know, this and that. And so we kind of upset a lot of people. They didn't know how to accept us at first. Matter of fact, a lot of times we got a lot of conflict and critiques from our more established and intelligent brothers and sisters. But, you know, people dug us though, man. And see, another thing too. There were a lot of people who were trying to bring us into their fold. The Black Panthers were trying to...
I was going
to
ask about that as well, yeah.
The Panthers were trying to bring us into their fold. The Nation of Islam wanted us into their fold. The Republic of New Africa, a lot of black groups. Because the people saw, those people in those groups, or the heads of those groups, saw how much the people loved The Last Poets. So whoever had The Last Poets, you know, had direct... to the people, but I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was an intelligent movement. I don't know if it was a sports movement. I don't know if it's just our destiny, but we never aligned ourselves with no one certain group. We always kept ourselves open. We remained independent because we wanted to be independent because if one group wanted to come and do us to do a benefit, we said, yeah, we can come and do a benefit. You know, we didn't want to say, no, we can't. We don't like your ideology. We don't like your philosophy. We can't do nothing. But we kept ourselves open. We get help and go support all groups. Man, that was a deep thing. And still, that today, we still kind of, that dependence is still part of who we are.
That's incredible. And I know that Malcolm was a very important figure to all of you guys.
Yeah, right. Well, the fact, too, for me, more than anything, because he came out of the street like I did, and he changed and transformed his life. You know, he became, you know, probably one of the most, you know, intellectual black people at that time. I mean, you go to Rhodes College. I mean, you go to Rhodes. I mean, University of, in England, Oxford, and you have, I mean, debates with professors from Oxford, and you are excommunicated from the street, and at one time called Satan, and all of a sudden you can go hold your own and such. Areas and research personages of that. Yeah, Malcolm inspired a lot of people. Matter of fact, he was the reason I became Muslim, but I didn't join the Nation. People always ask me, even Mr. Farrakhan asked me, he said, Mom, why won't you join? I said, I don't like bow ties. I didn't like bow ties. That's the only thing that kept me out of the Nation of Islam. I did not like bow ties. But then even the brothers, though, like any other form of art or craft or fashion of Western world, we take it and we make it look cool, because after a while, we don't look too bad in their bow ties, but that's the only reason I didn't join the Nation of Islam, because I like bow ties, man.
That's incredible. I wanted to ask about your voice.
Mm-hmm.
You have a very distinctive voice when you're reciting poetry.
You know, everybody always tell me that, man.
Yeah.
I'm beginning to believe that.
Finally started to believe it.
Yeah, I am.
When did you first start hearing that? When did you start thinking, hey, man, when I say stuff in public, I can get people to listen to me?
You know, I just started about the last 5 years. Not when I was young, but now I got older, because I've noticed that in some times when I'm in a room and some people are drinking, but when I start my poetry, gradually, it's quiet. Baba Tunde hit me. He said, Mike, you listen now, people, you come in, you can start this quiet, if you think it quiet. And it's deep. Because this Alma was in my voice. Well, my father, he had a nice voice. He could sing, he had a nice sing. I can't sing. I guess that's why I became a poet. First, I couldn't play the trumpet either, because I have a brother who he could pick it up and pull his armatures. So he could crisp, but I guess I was supposed to be the poet of the family. But there's a musical thing in me, and it's like people hear it in my phrasing, too, when I do poetry. It's like sometimes you're blowing a horn. But like I grew up listening to my father, so that part tested me a whole lot. You know, he tested me very much. And I'm glad that I can acknowledge my father now, the influence that he is, and I am, as people tell me, because at one time I almost killed him one night. I almost took his life, but my mother saved him. You know, she said, you know, you didn't want to do that. And I now realize I didn't want to do that. You know, but there was a lot of contention between me and him growing up, because the thing that I was becoming more strong each day and becoming a little more responsible, people depending on me more today, became a little rival there for a minute, man. You know? And that's deep.
Yeah, that's... And writing, I wanted to ask you about your writing. How do you feel it's changed over the years, both the stuff you do under your own name and under... within the last poem?
Well, I'm getting a little more personal now. I'm a little more personal things about my life and the things I got a poem called Shoeshine Boy that I haven't done in public yet. A lot of people like, but I haven't done in public. Writing a poem about my father and him being a musician and the contention that both of them. Writing, things about some of the women who've been in my life. So it's getting a little personal. Like, I haven't, used on this poetry yet, but hopefully I will begin to put it out there soon. So I'm going to it more personally because of the struggle that I overcame with my demons, and the fact that I overcame my demons in my own way, and despite what other people were trying to tell me how I should do, what aspects and what ideas they had of how I should do it, I did it my way, right? Because nobody knew myself better than me, I know my demons because I helped nurture them, I helped, them bloom, blossom, I used them when I was, so nobody knew my demons better than I did myself. The only one who would get rid of them was me. I mean, totally just, come on. And then, I was blessed with a little grandson I've been helping raise for the last 7 years. He helped. I had to give up a whole lot of stuff to him. With this little boy, he watched me all the time. Granddaddy, where you going? Where you going, Granddaddy? I'm going with you. No, she can't go with me. So I had to wind up, when he was 3 years old, matter of fact, he just had a birthday last week. When he was three, and I would take him in the car and I would buckle him up. It's okay, Granddaddy, I'll buckle up, you buckle up. I never buckle up. I used to drive 135, 109. Everybody knew that. Doing the tail and everybody. I'd be speeding like crazy, but I wouldn't have no buckle on. I just speed even. I like being fit. Because you know what? I asked this hillbilly in Flint, Michigan. He had a motorcycle. This is about 20 years. Well, even before I know him, I wasn't using a seatbelt. But I asked him, I said, why, man? Well, what makes you guys feel so free when y'all riding those bikes on the highway? He said, listen, you don't see no seatbelt on that motherfucker, do you? I said, boy, you right. Ain't no seatbelt on there, you right. So I said, well, I'm happy, man. I'm like the bike riders. I'm free and fast and free. Rolling too fast sometimes.
But then your grandson... Mm-hmm. Wanting to buckle up made you realize
I have to, because I want to set an example. I would like to be here to see him grow up a little more,
Jumping forward a little bit, I know that you did, I saw you did the liner notes to the Miles Davis album that Bill Laswell remixed of Miles' Fusion Period. And that made me really interested. I was hoping you could talk about that period of Miles' career. The real almost like rock.
I don't give a fuck what nobody said about Miles. Miles was always Miles. No matter what fucking music Miles was playing, it was Miles Davis. Miles was just Miles was one of the most unique fucking musicians, and I loved him not for his music, but for his style, his class, his bravado. Everybody wanted to be like Miles. Because Miles, the clothes, the dress, the women, because Miles just touched them, we were like, that was our boy. I got a passage in one of my poems where I speak about Miles, man. Miles, and plus that, because that's my father. taught me about. The street, my father was a trumpet player. The street trumpet, he just dug. There was nobody else. It was, of course, Satchmo, you know, Pops, Miles, and this white guy from New Orleans, Al Hurt. You ever heard of him?
I haven't.
Oh, man, this big white boy from New Orleans. This boy, the sound, my daddy liked his sound. You look up Al Hurt, go to Google. But so those are three. But Roland Satchmo, he always respected Satchmo because he said Satchmo was the beginning. But he said Miles just took it and gave it a whole nother tone. You know, that's why I love Miles. So I grew up with Miles, listening to him, my uncles, you know, and listening to some of his records. So, but the thing that I'm telling you, man, John, I have been given some honors, man, that I never thought I would get. You know, man, just like when the brother, what's his name, wrote I forgot his name, he wrote the autobiography of Miles, and Miles said in that book that the last poets, James Brown and Marvin Gaye, inspired his Down on the Corner album. That shit, you know, he was a man that I admired, he said I inspired him. And we met Miles a couple of times. I know the first time we met him, we was at the university, the Forum, and that's when it was the Forum before they made the Staples Center. We did a gig with him and Nina Simone. And so we met him the first time I met him. It was a hell of a concert. First time I met him, he said, yeah, yeah, love what you guys do. Love what you guys do. Keep it up, keep it up.
Rap beef.
So, oh, shit, that was Miles. That's all I needed. It was Miles. Love and so. But when he said that, man, that was a, that, ooh. I mean, you know, he's a cat that I wanted to be like. Just idolized, you know. Now he's telling me. And yeah, I don't know. Something, see, things are beginning to hit me now. Of what has happened and transpired for me being the last poet, for some words I said 40 years ago. Like in 1999, Vibe magazine made This Is Madness one of the top 100 albums of the 20th century. So when I heard it, I thought it was some other black poets like Sonia Sanchez and Gil Scott and us. But no, man, we were up there with Frank Sinatra, John Coltrane, Mick Jagger and the Beatles and Billie Holiday and, you know, and on, you know, Sonny Rollins. I'm saying, whoa, we in that company of the 20th century? So I can always tell, I got that album, I kept that album just for the reason. So my grandsons or their sons could look back and say, what, you know, great granddaddy did or what, you know, he had one of the best albums of the 20th century.
that's an unbelievable honor.
It really is, Sean.
Yeah.
And I was humbled by that, man. Because when I found out that I was in such with such personalities, it fucked me up. Because I was just 20 years old, 21 when I was writing that stuff. So, and it's 40 years ago. I said, man, oh, that's some deep shit, man. That really is, man.
Yeah. What about, I was wondering if you could talk about one of the tracks on that record, something we talked about before on your new verified Rap Genius account on Black Is Free. Even just the chant on that, that runs through the whole thing, that starts it and runs through the whole thing, and it's so iconic. Obviously, Digable Planets used it on a record.
Yeah, no.
It's just super well known, and it's so short and so powerful, and simple but so memorable, and it contains so much. I was hoping you could talk about that. And so the chant for our listeners who don't know, it's black is you,
black is us, black is free, black is me, black is you, black is us, black is free. Yeah, so when I did that, because you know what, another thing too, people always tell me how they love that poem, not just even in the background, but I always thought that was my lesser poems, man. I did, Sean. I never thought that as one of them related to what black people, what you gonna do, niggas scared of revolution because, and a couple other things I do now, personal things, and AM that I did on Bill Laswell's album. These are some of the, I feel are my iconic pieces, but everybody always tell me, man, we love black, we love that thing, man, we love that poem. And I'm saying, why? Was it just, it's just some of the way you say the words in it, and like you too, a lot of people say. So so when I did the poem, me and Zalal got together, it was Zalal helping me with most of that. He put most of the things, he started it, black as us, black as me, black as us, black as you, black as free, and black as, you know, so I... And then I think about a month ago I was listening to it, man, and I said, yeah, I can feel that thing now. And, you know, sometimes you, like I tell poets now, like I was saying when I was out there, real fucked up, niggas scared of revolution would come to me, and the world would be, Omar, you scared of revolution? Look at you, what happened? You know, so poets, I tell poets sometimes, you got to listen to your own stuff. You know, you got to go back and listen to what you said, because there's things that can help you too. Not the fact that you have helped other people and you've brought other people some struggles. Now you might need to go back and listen to some of your own stuff to get through the struggle yourself.
And you've alluded to it a couple of times in this interview, but you had a period where you were having a hard time with drugs.
Yeah.
How did you eventually get past that?
It's just been a struggle, man. It's been a struggle. It's been some demons. See, but the whole thing about my drug use, I never lied about it. Because, you know, I know I was on a radio station about for 15 years ago, and the interviewer said, well, Mom, I mean, you know, what made you go into the drugs? Was it because you were from a dysfunctional family? Well, you could, because you were from a dysfunctional family, you were poor, and you grew up black in the project. I said, oh, no, man, I like getting high. Since I was young, I like fucking up my head, man, pills and shit. And I mean, I like getting high. That was my thing. I mean, the higher I get, the better I feel. I get high and want to have fun and run through the street and my speed on my car. I like getting high. So it was no putting that shit on white or racism or institutional. I like getting fucked up, okay? So I did, and you know, but when I started fucking with that cocaine, oh Jack, that was it. And somebody told me, well, don't fuck with that. Don't fuck with that. Nah, man, I can handle this. And then you'd be walking around, and say, people ask you, okay, yeah, I got it. You okay, Mo? Yeah, I got it. But you don't know how bad you got it. That shit is a motherfucker. And I had ran into this woman who, I ain't mentioning no names, she ran drugs. Out of the house, and she had cocaine everywhere, man. You know, in drawers, and I'm just snorting. But she told me, said, the first minute I catch you smoking, you're out of here. And she said, the first minute I hear about you smoking? So this Muslim brother, at the time, was humbly lost, and all liquor. This brother was talking shit. Well, Mom, we're black men, and nobody can handle this shit like us. This is me. Listen to this motherfucker talk this shit to me, sound like, because we black and we the Asiatic black man. This is me. So I take a hit on that motherfucker. Listen, and this was when I first started. It was like freebase, and this was.
What time period is this to give a little?
This is about 79. So I take a hit on that shit. This one was with the ether and the cooked up with the ether and shit. This is it. This is what I've been looking for. This shit I've been looking for. So I went from champagne and freebase to cracking on English just like that. All over, Jack. Homeless, everything. People looking at me, is that Lamar? Yeah, that's Lamar. You know, I was in Baltimore one time. It was 115 degrees. That's what it was. It was 115 degrees, man, in Baltimore. And the day I went up, I got my check. It was on North Avenue. I got my check and my food stamps at the same time. Checked it all in, went around on Greenmount, hooked me up some shit. I'm smoking, walking down North Avenue in Baltimore at 115 degrees. I'm a motherfucking walking Niagara Falls. I'm, you know, fucked up. People ask, man, ain't that Lamar? I said, yeah, you know, I'm. But then something said, I'm like, this, you can't come on, man. Ooh, and like I said, too, because, well, I had first started coming back when I was in Michigan. I started working with real deep up there, but then when I moved to Baltimore, a lot of people, when I moved to Baltimore to look after my daughter and my grandson, because she got married, I know how they rolled in Baltimore, so I got to go out there and make sure that, you know, that silly ass stuff to away from them. You know, some said, okay, man, you're going to put your demons up against Baltimore's demons. Because Baltimore got some demons, Jack. Some drug demons, post-Civil War demons, slave demons, black demons, poor white demons, poor black demons. So we're going to put your demons up against these demons and see who's going to win. Well, they were sitting there, people call me, you know, when I first moved there, Lamar, you going to be okay now? And people were worried because, oh, shit, Lamar's in Baltimore. What the fuck are you doing in Baltimore? He ain't going to make it, he ain't going to make it. But I made it because I made up my mind to, phew, I'm putting these demons to rest in Baltimore. This is where it ends, right here. And then with the help of my little grandson, and it's just like the Almighty just sent him to put the cap, help me put the cap on it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Really, really glad. I was hoping, I'd read some incredible stuff that you'd said about just Afro-American music, Afro-diasporic music, and the connections that bring all these different genres together, you know, blues and hip-hop and jazz and all this kind of stuff, and its connection to African traditions and oral traditions and rhythm and things like that. I was hoping you could give our audience at least some of your I know it's a book's worth of stuff, but some of your thoughts on that.
But, well, it's just the fact that, you know, how we've gotten to this point, our music has gotten to this point. I mean, because we go back to a slave field, you know, when there were certain hollers and certain calls that, you know, kept the slaves inspired, and must all the hot sun and then beat down by the so-called cracking the whip on us, but yet it inspired us to get through the day, to get up, make it through the day, and make it through the next day. And on the chain gang, where you would see brothers making sounds with the chain, you know, making sounds with the chain, all that still from Africa. You know, and then on the railroads, when you see the brothers moving the rails on the track with the click clicks and the stomps, all that was part of our survival. All that was part of our soul still speaking to us, our African soul speaking to us. Listen, you may not have the money, you may not have the support, you may not have all the riches, but you got this rhythm of life that keeps you moving and keep you wanting to share with others and keep sharing it with others. So, man, it's just like the chain gangs and all of that. And then, of course, the blues coming out of the Mississippi Delta, man. You know, them brothers singing songs about life and love in the midst of some of the most horrible conditions, even after slavery. You know, I mean, they went from slaves to sharecroppers, which was no different than being slaves, but to sit up there and put music together that the whole world would live, that even was more loved by white people at some point than black people. You know, because, you see, white people identified with them more sometimes than we did, because, you know, even though they had their positions over us as masters and stuff, the things that we were saying in that music touched them too, because those hidden little things that they tried to hide away in the subway or whatever would come out in that music and expose their humanity too. See, the great thing about black people, no matter what condition that we've been in this country, we've helped other people expose their own lacks and their own, you know, imperfections, and they may not want to give us that props, but we did. So we've been a very important part of this culture. As a matter of fact, at Thompson, I think we have saved this culture and gave its impetus to try to be human. So all this music, man, and then, of course, Motown, when Motown came out in factories, man, I mean, the whole world was singing about it. Here's, you know, black people dressed up in silk suits and gowns, and they're showing class and style over the world. It was this thing that with our music and the sounds that we make, man, and just when we walk or talking, you know, that still keeps our humanity, still gives us a sense of humanity. Because more than blackness, I always talk about, people talk about the blackness, they didn't take away our blackness. Our slave master took away our humanity, and we've been trying to get that back and hold on to that for ages. Some of us forget how human we were because we let everybody come into Africa and study and take from us, you know, and then everybody came in Africa to use slavery because of stuff, but to still be here, you know, and to still be a part of to still want to love people, still be their friends after all we've been through, that's an amazing thing about us. And even in the position that we're in, our community is all disarray, age is going through our community, there's no, but we still have that thing called our rhythm. It's our basic survival. That's our basic survival problem, because sometimes we ain't got enough money, we'll buy a drink and get drunk and start dancing and singing, man. You know what we do best. Just like another thing, too, about dancing. I just love to dance. Well, that's how I made a lot of music. You know, I dance too in the comments? I think I said about dancing. Yeah, I dance for Eunice sometime. Dancing is a wonderful thing. You know, a lot of cats, man, you know, I don't dance, man, I don't get on dance floor. But warriors dance, man, warriors dance, warriors dance. They dance before they go to war, they dance before they pleasure the women. So dancing is a human thing, it's good for your soul. And that's one thing, you know, people look at homosexuals, that's one thing I respect about homosexuals, they dance. They love to dance because they know there's something in dancing. It touches their spirit, it makes them human. And that's what makes it human, because they love it. I used to go hang out with, I had friends who, and they love to dance, man. They'll dance in a minute. They'll get up, get drunk, start dancing. Blah, blah. But I understand why they're doing it now, because that's something in the spirit. You fully let that go and be able to share that with other people, because that's part of your human, is that rhythm, that thing to let it go and share. That's very human. See, I'm looking at some of these motherfuckers, yeah, Buta Hall, man, dance. Well, fuck you. Something wrong with you. Get away from me. Don't come near me. You know, learn how to dance. And dance is a wonderful thing. Dance is a celebration of your life. So no matter how much you've been down or oppressed or people fucked up, if you can still dance and dance to the music, you still head and shoulders above a whole lot of people, man. It's a very important part of who you are, to feel that rhythm, to feel that music, and to share it and let go. That's more healthy than you did a whole lot of trips to the doctor. Seriously, you know?
I wanted to ask you about your relationship with a contemporary of the last poets, and someone who's often lumped in with you as part of your movement, about Gil. What was your relationship with him like over the years? How did it start? How did it change?
What was it, like 2 years ago when he died? I was in California, and these friends I know finally took me up to the wine country. I'd been to California a lot of times, but I never been up to the wine country, Sean. Wine country fucked me up. I would just take a cab out of that motherfucker forever. The wine country fucked me up, Sean. You know, I didn't want to go to that. It's so beautiful up there. It's hot in the motherfucker, though. It's hot. It gets hotter than that motherfucker, but it's beautiful. So I'm like, fuck this. I'm telling you, yo, y'all go back. Just leave me here. Come stop fucking around no more. She couldn't know, because you go into the wine, you take the little sips. I was fucked up too, man. Keep. So I dug the wine company. So, okay, I'll go back. We'll go back to Oakland, man. So the next day, somebody calls me. I said, what's up? I said, well, let's check him on. Gil is dead. And it hit me because I love Gil Scott Heron, because he was one of the best human beings I knew, man. And I was hoping he could make it. I was hoping that boy could make it. And so, okay, I gathered myself together, and I said, okay, I want to be one of the first. I got to get back to New York. I want to be the first to do a tribute to him, since he was basically like one of us, a part of our brother, and I was. I had a sister, this friend of mine. She worked at WBII. And so I told him, man, get ahead of the director down there. So I'm going to come down, and me and Doom want to come down. We want to be the first to pay a tribute for Gil. And we did. I was down there doing that, and there's one guy from England whose name Malik Nugel. We did, and that, we gave him a tribute, man. And I didn't go to the funeral all the year. And I got this big, in my basement where I do my writing, I got a big picture of him and Malcolm and Gil. Those are my two. I wake up every morning looking at them, man. It's like two of my Midwestern contemporaries. They be looking at my mom. So that's another reason that made me want to, like, force forward and not go out the street, because of the way they died, man. Not only the way they died, but the way Huey Newton died, the way that David Ruffin died, the way that Marvin died. I mean, these are, Whitney too. Whitney just, man.
That guy, Dave?
Are you kidding? I was in love with that girl, man. I mean, I was in love with her more than Brown, and I lived from afar. I loved Whitney, man. And the way she was trying to fight it, she was being so open about it. I thought she was going to make it. I really did, Sean. I thought she was going to make it, and I was praying for it. But then that night, that next morning when I saw her on the news, they showing her with her hair ruffled, she's sweating, and that wine rolling down the leg. I know she had lost the battle. I know she wasn't going to make it. I know she had quit and given up. See, because with those demons, you can't quit. You got to fight them to the end, man. You got to fight to the end, because, see, that's the whole thing, is to kill you. No matter how much fun you think you have with the drugs, their thing is to kill you. And when one of them got to me, listen, I had a little discussion with them motherfuckers one night later. What's up? Yeah, we can't kill you, motherfucker. See, my whole thing in my life is never let nobody hurt me. Like me carrying the screwdriver and the shot and the never, I ain't let nobody hurt me, because my father used to like moonstrap me. So my thing was outside of him, I ain't let nobody else hurt me. And so I'm like, these was like two motherfucking niggas on the street telling me they get ready to hug me. I said, motherfucker, what? I said, we gonna kill you. You don't know you having fun getting your dick sucked, riding around, smoking with all the hoes in your car, and you know, getting your little sexual, but we can really kill your ass, nigga. I said, like, whoa, wait a minute, you motherfuckers, oh, you gonna talk back to us, bitch? Yeah, y'all ain't killing me. I went to war, man. I had to go to war with these motherfuckers. I gotta go to war and straight with some white boy, some stupid nigga in bounce will try to hurt me. You ain't gonna get me, I'm gonna get y'all first. And it's been up and down for the last 10 years. People see me doing good, they see me down, but now that everybody see that I really got that, I'm just like, damn, this nigga did it. I'm, damn, this boy got. Because I ain't, no, man. First of all, that little grandson, I wanna be here a little more while. You know, I wanna see him at 18, see what type of man he gonna be, or how I influenced his life. That's why I fought. That's why for him, man.
Real quick, one final thing that I wanted to ask you was, you and Avi O'Doom have been probably the two most consistent members of the Last Poets over the years, and you guys have been working together for, four decades now, right?
Yeah,
40 years.
Not 4 decades. We both left. I left one time.
You left.
But... And we just got back together in 1918. That's stupid. About 1990, because of the album I did with Bill Lazarus.
With Laswell, yeah.
So we decided, because I had called to ask everybody else. See, because the thing was, Bill Lazarus had money for everybody. He wanted to get all of us into the studio, you know. And I had went in and did a little thing down with Jalal, and then before he went back to California or wherever, this was back in Jalal told him, don't listen to him, but come to find out, Bill had given Jalal some money to get all of us into the studio, but he kept it. So he heard my voice again. He said, well, Mom, let's do something. Let's do an album. Your voice is still strong. It's still the same voice. You still got the stuff. Well, I said, okay. Jalal got mad with that because he told me, well, you know, we don't listen to Bill. But I did that. We did Bill up there. And I invited Felipe and E-Max, Scott and Kane and the Netherlands to do Bill. Bill will tell you, I'm not emailing my facts. He will tell you, I invited all of them into the studio. Because Bill wanted to work. I said, oh, no, man, we don't want you working with too many white people. I'm working with too many white people. Who, any black people ever offered us to put us in the studio? Or any white black people ever offered us? Oh, get the fuck out of with that bullshit. So I knew Doom would come, because Doom always liked to have a forum. He'd give Doom a forum, he'll be ready to do anything. So he came, we hung out. And we've been doing this for about 23 years now, him and me and Bob Atunde.
You know. What is it about you two that you work so well together?
Well, we know how to work well together. We're totally different people now. Doing grew up middle class in Queens, and I grew up hanging out, you know. So we had some differences, and there have been times when we've been close to, you know, but like we cut all that off when we're on stage to show two black men can work together in spite of all our differences. That's our biggest thing, man. You know, we're not as close as everybody thinks. You know, I mean, I work with him, but, you know, he's a great partner on stage, man. Yes. You know, and that's what makes it work.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming today.
Yo,
it was a great honor. And
My pleasure.
That was our conversation with Umar Ben Hassan. I was so proud to bring it to you guys. There is a ton of amazing content from Umar actually on Rap Genius. If you check his verified account, you'll find a comic book about his early days as a shoeshine boy in Akron. He talks about it in the early part of the interview. And you'll find his verified annotations on some of the Last Poets' work. Really, really incredible stuff. It was fascinating for me to hear Umar talk about his arrival in Harlem. I'm sitting here in 2013 Harlem, in a building on top of a Starbucks near a Rite Aid, and when he got here in 1969, it was just a whole different world. Revolution seemed right around the corner in a way that is unthinkable now. There was a vibrant black arts movement, just an entirely different scenario than exists in Harlem today. And it was incredible to hear about. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
Okay, man. My name is Brother Omar. I'm a security man. What's up?
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
The thing was, like, David would probably get me down there and set me up in somewhere and kill me.
Special research and internet assistance from Julia Hannafin.
I used to drive 135 miles. I knew everybody knew I was doing it to you and everybody. I know I'd be speeding like crazy, but I wouldn't have no buckle on.
Our music is by Psionic.
So no matter how much you've been down or oppressed or people fucked over you, you can still dance.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter at OTL_podcast for all the latest Outside the Lines information. You can find all our past shows, subscribe so you never miss an episode, and leave us a review on iTunes. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests like Umar Ben Hassan. Join us in 2 weeks when writer Adam Mansbach returns to the show, this time to talk about his new novel, The Dead Run. He brings along with him the absolutely incredible poet, Kevin Koval. We'll see you in 2 weeks, Outside the Lines. Oh, yeah. Make... Find it...
If you like.
Hold on a second.